everyone, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy and pluralism. This is Omar Sadr, a research associate at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. My guest in this episode is Samuel Mond, who is the Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale University. Trained in the modern European intellectual history, he works on political and legal thought in modern times, and on constitutional and international law in historical and current perspective. In this conversation, we discuss his most recent book titled Liberalism Against Itself, Cold War Intellectuals, and the Making of Our Times, published by Yale University Press in 2023. The book suggests that the current challenges of liberalism are rooted in the inability of Cold War liberals to defend liberal credentials. By Cold War liberal, he refers to 1940s and 50s intellectuals, including Isa Berlin, Karl Popper, Jacob Talman, Gertrude Himmelfarb, Leonel Trilling, and Judith Schakler. According to him, Cold War liberals failed to embrace and defend equality. This paved the way to the libertarian notion of liberalism, which embarked on a militaristic form of new liberalism. With this, on to the podcast. Well, Samuel Mond, welcome to Negotiating Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating book, and it's timely because liberalism has been debated both by philosophers, legal philosophers, political scientists, sociologists at our time. Many may argue that, well, there are certain fundamental flaws within liberal assumptions when we have to rethink and recalibrate about it. Many may say that we have to abandon it. And I think you have a very nuanced analysis that you argue in the book that we don't have to abandon the liberal philosophy and its core assumptions, that you draw it back to 19th century. In a state, you have a certain problem with a very narrow history of it, two decades that you study, the 1940s and 50s. So probably for the sake of audience, briefly, if you can say, why do you think, and then Cold War liberals that you characterize the six figures as Cold War liberals, and they went wrong, and the implications for the contemporary era that we face now, and probably also what was the motivation behind writing this book at this particular time?
Well, I just should begin by saying that I think that there has been a debate since 2016, prompted by the Brexit vote and Donald Trump's election in the United States, and it was a debate about the future of liberalism. And in general, it was like a binary debate. There were people who excoriate liberalism and people who extenuate. And I found both unpersuasive because they didn't seem to be talking about the history of liberalism as I have studied it. And they actually agreed about that history, that liberalism is about 500 years old and Anglophone and, rooted in the thought of John Locke, and it's individualist and libertarian. And they just disagreed about whether it was good or bad. I had read a lot about liberalism that made me wonder if this was the right way to have the debate. And so when I was invited to give some lectures, I wanted to focus on that general debate and reorienting it. And what I argued basically is that liberalism, we know from other historians like Helena Rosenblatt, arises in a self-styled form in the 19th century, and it's very different from liberalism as it's represented in the current debate, because it is in kind of technical jargon of political theory, it's perfectionist. It isn't about privatizing ideas about the good life. It's about saying there's a new idea of the good life, individual creativity and collective perfectibility. And so that seemed of great importance. And then I was interested in how the debate could be kind of missing the point of liberalism. And I began to think it was because of a mutation in liberalism in the middle of the 20th century. And so the lectures and later the book are about that transformation. It gave us the kind of liberalism that is on like the kind of stand of kind of prosecutors and defenders today, you know, which the 20th century is when John Locke was made a liberal, and it is in the recent decade something that's more individualist and economistic. And yet I wanted to say that's the trial of liberalism today is about one version and really a recent one.
Sure. So this leads me to ask also a question about if we have a single form of liberalism. And I think what I infer from your book and what you argued now about history of liberalism, that we have multiple liberalisms. And that's something like other scholars like John Gray also argue, that we cannot probably have a discrete episode of history of thought, which we call it liberalism. Or even he asked the question, does liberalism has a history? Because according to him, it might be a fault assumption to view John Locke, Kant, Smith, and Mill as expositor of a single tradition of ideas. And Gray himself, I highlight, I think, in the book, Two Faces of Liberalism, two different traditions that they all together, probably the even fundamental assumptions of these two traditions are quite different. One is based on an ideal way of life, which Kant and Locke according to him. And then the other tradition is tradition of tolerance, which Hobbes and Hume is advocating of. And I think what I inferred from your book is that you also criticize that the Cold War liberals abandoned the notion of perfectionism and progress. And hence, you somehow go towards the a version of liberalism that should advocate an ideal way of life. First, so two things here. First, do you think that we have really different traditions of liberalisms that we should use it in a plural term? And second, do you agree with my understanding that you advocate for a highest way of life should, or the ultimate goal that they say, should be the core of liberalism in a state of tolerance or peaceful coexistence in a way?
So I'm generally in agreement. Maybe where I would disagree with John Gray is that, you know, I start as a kind of nominalist, and neither David Hume nor Immanuel Kant called themselves liberals. Now, maybe that doesn't matter. They certainly can be seen as proto-liberals of a kind. Thomas Hobbes too, although he's substantially earlier and is like the least plausible to call even a proto-liberal. But I do agree that that there are two liberalisms. When you take the nominalist view as I do, all the early liberals, the ones who called themselves liberals, are trend in that perfectionist direction. And that means that in a sense, liberalism is born with one face. And it's important to say that because the liberal perfectionism is a perfectionism about the desirability of freedom, it will have tolerationist implications. What it refuses to do is adopt a kind of deep tolerationism, which says that, you know, liberals can't be for a highest life of their own. Rather, it's that you know, that very commitment leads liberals to give individuals and groups a certain amount of leeway. But that's very different from, say, Thomas Hobbes's view that we need a strong state to keep religious zealots from killing one another. And that the state will, in a sense, you know, have no view about the truth. So I guess I would then come down in saying, you know, where Gray might go wrong is he's not able to see that there's a very strong kind of sequence where there was one face of liberalism that's dominant, and it's this perfectionist one. And then in the 20th century, a much more tolerationist liberalism takes its place. He's a philosopher. I'm a historian. So my interest is in, like, not just the possible faces of liberalism, but which face kind of is showing, including to us today. And so I see much more a story of transition from one dominant form to another dominant form.
Hmm. And I think that's also because the same that I think this assumption also makes you to critique John Rawls also in your book. First of all, you say that Rawls is very belated in the tradition of Cold War liberals. And secondly, according to you, Rawls also puts coexistence and tolerance ahead of the highest life. And that's the problem for you. But I might also push you here, because many scholars at this moment argue that our societies are facing the challenges of peaceful coexistence. We cannot argue, or we cannot come together and forge a consensus even on a very minimal set of values in our liberal pluralistic societies. For example, America. You mentioned Donald Trump since 2016. And that is what liberalism should tackle or address. Ideally, liberalism emerged after the 30 years of war in Europe as an ideology to bring peace together, right, in a society which doesn't have consensus. So I wonder if liberalism still should prioritize this issue of peaceful coexistence as we face it today, or not.
Well, you know, there's endless fascination in John Rawls's thought. Actually, there's an even newer book by Alexandre Lefebvre called Liberalism as a Way of Life, which purports to show that Rawls was a perfectionist. I follow the, you know, conventional wisdom that he says in especially his book Political Liberalism, that he is not for a comprehensive liberalism. He's aware that his predecessors in the 19th century were perfectionist, and he disclaims that stance in favor of a tolerationist one. I don't think it is a sustainable version of liberalism. But what I would emphasize in response to your question is that he was really, in a sense, like many liberals, damaged by the, you know, right wing, Ronald Reagan, revolution, which seemed to him to be heading towards a kind of, you know, like contest between the religious and the secular. And he was very afraid of the so-called moral majority that Christians purported to represent in the 1980s. I would say it turns out that, you know, there isn't a deep disagreement about the good life between the religious and the secular. You know, religion has continued its decline. There is a disagreement between left and right, or liberals and conservatives in the United States today, but it's not exactly about religion anymore. it's about policy. And I think one big reason that it's about policy is that both liberals and conservatives have been neoliberals for the past, you know, few decades. And this is not what Rawls wanted either. You know, when he published his greatest book, A Theory of Justice, before political liberalism in 1971, he accepted a lot of Cold War liberal views about freedom and the state, but he did call for economic fairness, but he just had no influence. And the era we've lived in has been a neoliberal one rather than a Rawlsian one. And so I would say the problem is we do have a dominant vision of the best life that has triumphed at the hands of both liberals and conservatives. And I'm trying to save liberalism from that mistake, because I think that's allowed conservatives, in part with religious help, but not mainly as a religious phenomenon, kind of dominate our era. I don't think we're in on the brink of a civil war in general, and especially not a religious war of the kind that, you know, led Thomas Hobbes to his views. So I think the tolerationist case is substantially weakened by recent history, not strengthened by it.
Well, if we don't have religious violent war as we had it earlier during Thomas Hobbes, but definitely we have a cultural war going on, at least in the United States, and it's quite evident. Today is the elections day, and you see the shift which happened in Democratic Party base. Earlier it was working class. Now the working class has shifted towards Republicans. People like J.D. Vance is coming from a working class background, but at the same time, he's the one who is also subscribing to Patrick Deneen's idea of conservative, very conservative Christian critique of liberalism. You address Deneen in your book, and Deneen is substantially coming from a religious point of view, and he brings in a critique that liberalism has taken out all our morality and our values, and we have to go back to the ancient notion of liberty, which is rooted in Greece. And so he don't you think that still there is a contestation which is on identity, on values, wokeism, and religion, which means we should not neglect all of those?
Yes, it's a very good question. I would say we should get right what the actual debate turns on. Because I agree with your presentation that, you know, you could take the current standoff of Democrats and Republicans, or Deneen's, basically religious outlook to kind of prove that there's just a divide. But then you look more closely and, you know, Deneen does not present himself primarily as a spokesperson of a religious or even Roman Catholic perspective. And he shares a lot with liberals and left liberals like me. He's very critical of the American states wars, which have set the country back, not to mention the world. He's a bitter critic of neoliberalism. And that's because he's influenced by the left, and he had left-wing teachers like Benjamin Barber and Carrie McWilliams. And he, to an extent, his complaints are about that same hegemonic form of liberalism I'm complaining about. Now, of course, his response seems to be critical of liberalism to the point of abandoning it and recommending, you know, going back to the Middle Ages. But that's not what Americans want, very few. And so I would say, like the election today is about, well, you know, what is there going to be a sequel to militarism and neoliberalism in either party? And it's not clear because we're in a kind of interregnum period where each party is kind of halfway beyond its old commitments to a mistaken form of liberalism. And then a lot depends on like what those sequels are. And my sense is that, you know, the proper sequel, which would be a more emancipatory form of liberalism, could gain a pretty big majority of the country, just as it did during Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. And it's not that the people are in disagreement, it's that they're hostage to neoliberalism.
On the issue of neoliberalism, two quick points I have. One is that many scholars on the right may say that the term neoliberalism itself is pejorative because no one claims to be a neoliberal themselves. It's a label that others, probably the left.
Well, that's not true because it was originally coined by figures in the Mont Pelerin Society itself. But it doesn't really matter what we call it as long as we can all agree what we're talking about.
Sure. But Hayek, for example, the main philosopher who is considered as a neoliberal, he never uses the term neoliberal in his own writing for himself. That's one. But the other point, even some of these rights may also argue that the fact that we associate deregulation as the one of the key features of neoliberalism actually didn't happen exactly. We had highest deregulations, of course, before Reagan. The very large state which was regulating the market still exists. So the point that we had a moment in our history after the Cold War, probably, that the state shrank and became less, and the market somehow expanded all spheres of life, actually doesn't exist. So these two points. So first, you address the first one that, well, we may agree on, certain scholars may agree on what is neoliberalism. But on the content of it, do you think that we are in a neoliberal age where a state is minimal and doesn't have any regulatory authority and everything is life, everything in life is market?
No, of course not. And that's not what people mean by, you know, critics of neoliberalism mean by the term. I mean, it is common agreement that, you know, the United States, if that's what we're talking about, spends more on its military than it has since the, you know, first years after the Second World War. And that it spends more on entitlements for its aging population than ever. And so no one could claim that we have a night watchman state. Anyway, neoliberals, the ones who called themselves that, did so because they wanted to distinguish themselves from classical liberals, in part because they thought they had to erode the welfare revolution, but also because they believed in ways that classical liberals did not, in governance, namely governance for the sake of protecting markets, and especially at the international level. They did a lot of governance work, built institutions like the World Trade Organization. And so I guess, for the sake of this conversation, I'll just observe that I'm not making a contribution to the history of neoliberalism. I do presuppose that something in attitudes towards the state and its role did change in the middle of the period since World War II, and that there's a problem to solve about why that happened and what the intellectual origins were, and therefore, in my case, what the connection was or may be between Cold War liberalism and neoliberalism. But of course, we would need a nuanced description of what exactly changed. I mean, I do think that, there's no doubt that the taxation rate changed. There's very, I think large consensus that, the class structure changed such that the very rich could return to reaping many more gains than they had, you know, relative to the rest in the middle of the 20th century. And I think there is also very broad agreement that notwithstanding the fact that the American state is very large, there has been a concerted attack on some kinds of bureaucratic power, like in the sphere of control over banking and financial markets, and control over environmental rules that would govern industry. So it can't be the case that you say that there wasn't some complete transformation and therefore nothing happened. That's absurd. Something happened. It's not a matter of all or nothing. It's a matter of more or less. And of course the details matter, but not for the sake of this book.
No, I do not neglect the fact that there has not been a transformation. That transformation has happened. And of course the Washington Consensus and the way the idea of state was reconceived, that happened in 1990s and post-Cold War era. But I mean, philosophically, the basic idea, this distinction between positive and negative rights of Eyes of Berlin that you have in your book, also the Berlin debate, the right may say that it's enough to have negative liberties, not only in societies like United States, but also in societies with very weak state, like Afghanistan.
Yes.
Where state doesn't have enough capacity, both
yes.
in terms of institutions, but also financially, to endorse a certain notion of positive liberties, entitlements for the people. How the bankrupt and state like Afghanistan should finance itself in order to supply certain, should commit itself, for example, to certain services like free education, free healthcare, take care of elderly, let's say, so on and so forth. But they may argue a negative notion of liberty may allow self-governance, and society without a state may have certain capacities to rule themselves. They don't need the state to be there. They know how to rule themselves at the very core, for example, minimal level, the village level. Traditionally, informal governance institutions, customary institutions exist, and the people enjoy their liberty and freedom. So the fact that as soon as we bring in this very big positive liberty endorsement of the state, that creates itself a dilemma where state should have to tax more the people who doesn't have money in order to finance certain programs. So I think this dilemma exists between positive and negative liberty, not just in the United States, but also in many other. So what would be your take on that?
That all makes sense to me. I think whether to have a VAT tax to raise money for the state, I think that's very credible. In an early phase of trying to do some different project, the state may well want to rely on consumption taxation, just to raise a lot of money quickly, and without confronting the rich and so forth. That's a policy argument at a different level than I'm working in the book. I really sympathize with the view you're outlining, that there are different kinds of states and there may be different problems to solve in and under them. And of course, the low capacity states may invite the project of building capacity, or they might invite the project of seeking shelter from not just the state, but oppressive social forces. I'm the last person to deny the importance of negative liberty, but I don't think that's what the debate concerns. It concerns, you know, what kind of ideal liberalism should be, you know, developed, and it will be of different, like, appeal to different people sooner rather than later. And in cases where neoliberalism has had a substantial impact on the state and there's a massive backlash to it in the form of, you know, populism, my sense is a more perfectionist and progressivist liberalism would be, you know, a great boon sooner rather than later. That may not be true places which are not situated and, you know, and facing the same problems. I do think that nowhere in the world does it make sense to me to say that they prove that a libertarian form of liberalism is the final answer about what kind of theory it is. And that doesn't mean there can't be situational priorities, but that's, again, not like what the debate's about. I mean, I do have a chapter in the book about the post-colonial world in which I kind of charge that the Cold War liberals were just not interested in it. And so, you know, I am personally in favor of a cosmopolitan liberalism that thinks about freedom and its problems on a world scale, but that what might well mean that it has to think about different ways in looking at different states and different pathologies that need to be remedied.
Let me ask you on this to outline. You pointed the Cold War liberals were not interested about question of equality and freedom for the Third World or the South. On the other hand, we have the new liberals, which were quite militaristic towards, they wanted to export and impose democracy and liberalism through military intervention. It happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Iraq, and subsequently in other places. So while both of these had flaws, we can't export democracy and liberalism in a society which doesn't have minimal conditions.
Absolutely.
And the idea, it will be very quite dangerous to intervene and kill people in order to liberate them. But what would be your proposition? What should we do in terms of, first of all, you said cosmopolitan outlook. Practically, yeah. What does it entail? Few steps.
Well, just for the sake of your listeners, I'm just going to observe that my book is about the 1930s through 1950s. And so when it charges that, in a sense, liberals of that era were not ambitious enough and really, you know, disregarded the decolonization of the world, which was an extraordinary moment in the history of liberalism, among other histories, I have in mind that era. Of course, it's true that later movements, especially neoconservatism, which I think also arises in the book only because I deal with one of its founders when she was a young person and a Cold War liberal. Her name was Gertrude Himmelfarb. It's absolutely true that when it took on a kind of obligation to develop an aggressive Reaganite policy at the end of the Third War towards other countries, it adopted a militarist one. And in a sense, that was counteracting the lack of ambition for freedom around the world with the wrong kind of ambition. And it was one that, like, engaged in magical thinking about military force and its potentially liberating effects. And I think there's a happy medium. There's no contradiction between saying that one set of liberals 40 years earlier was insufficiently ambitious and saying that neoconservatives were wrongly ambitious. And so I don't fault the neocons for being cosmopolitan. I fault them for being militarist. So that would suggest that, you know, liberals who look abroad and see despotism should have some response, but it's not going to be the one that they adopted for most of the 19th century, which was formal empire, or in the 20th of informal empire plus occasional, you know, military intervention. I think, you know, there was a promising form of liberal cosmopolitanism in the earliest era of its history, when liberals sympathized with freedom fighters around the world. And you could interpret some forms of the human rights movement as like the last gasp of that. It's not so much about aiding them militarily as, you know, trying to find the liberals wherever they are around the world and helping them, including helping them expose the, you know, infractions that their states are engaged in. And that's, you know, that's a contribution. I think in the end, we have to acknowledge that spreading freedom where there's not a tradition of it, or, you know, institutions and that can incubate it, is just extremely difficult. But that doesn't mean you relinquish the task.
Sure, but still, I think probably there is some sort of similarity between the Cold War liberals and the contemporary ones of our age in terms of their outlook and outreach towards the non-Western societies. You point out how the Cold War liberals were somehow implicitly, they had a hierarchical set of assumptions about the world of people in other parts of it. Berlin's visit to India, for example, and how he reflected on that, or Arendt's idea about the African people and the way they were savages. Even now, many skepticals may argue that how liberals, like Anne Applebaum, they advocate for liberalism in Ukraine, but when it comes to other parts of the world, like gender apartheid in Afghanistan or the massacre in Middle East, they're quite silent. So there is a European world where liberalism is appropriate, and there's another world where no one talks about it. Do you agree with that? That still the contemporary liberals also have.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think there are, you know, there's I talk in the book about how there's a revival of Cold War liberalism, and it tends to have the same Atlanticist bias of the Cold War liberals in the past. I'm not sure that, you know, Anne Applebaum is really a neocon who is arguing less for invading various places because she understands it's no longer propitious to do so after the Iraq war and after the Libyan intervention. And she has found a case, the Ukraine war, where there's just more like enthusiasm given Vladimir Putin's aggression for war. And I guess I would doubt that she's a case that's just like disinterested in global freedom. It's that she's lived a period in which neocons have had to fall silent about something they once very much cared about and may still believe in. And that's just very different than the Cold War liberals in you know, the early period whom I chronicle, who just didn't care that much about Afghanistan or India, because I think they were more affected by the traditional racialism of you know, liberal thinking across the Atlantic. But you make a good point. I think It whatever the reason why liberals like Applebaum are very loud about Ukraine and silent about the rest of the world, it's a double standard and should be called out. That what would be terrible is if she heard you and responded by saying we should go to war more places. I would hope she would, and other, you know, neoconservatives would develop other tools for thinking about the fate of freedom on the world stage than just, you know, sending military force.
Yeah, you point in the book that liberals should learn how to spread freedom without empire or something like that. Another question about Vogue. It's quite evident that, I mean, so many scholars has written recently about how liberalism has turned identitarian. Both extremes on the left wing of it or the right wing of it. But I think your point about Cold War liberals are quite contrasting with those liberals, contemporary liberals who develop a critique of wokeism. And I particularly refer to Yosha Mung's recent book, Identity Trap, where Yosha tries to argue that Marxism and the critical theory has been the main problem that left has tried to endorse it and shift the basis of liberalism. And that somehow from equality, the issue of social justice and equality, which was met initially a material issue or economic inequality, now moved to the issue of identity and culture. And that became a problem, which is woke. Now, you, on the other hand, argue that it was Cold War liberals who tried to put the blame on Hegel's historicism, Karl Marx, and French Revolution and Romanticism. So I think you both have this contrasting point of view. You try to bring back French Revolution as a base for liberal idea. You want to have a rereading of Rousseau and a different version of Hegel's probably historicism. And of course, you also argue that there were liberals who endorsed certain ideas of Marx. Marx inspires very liberals. But on the other hand, these scholars like Yosha Mung, who has problem with woke, they argue it was Marxian notion and critical theory, Foucault and post-structuralism, which caused this problem. Because you're a left liberal, so how do you defend this now?
It's an excellent question. I agree that I'm saying something very different from Yasha and other, you know, critics of identity politics. Mark Lilla would be another example. I think those are Cold War liberals who have found a new surrogate for communism in identity politics. And once again, they overstate its importance, and, you know, in particular, Yasha's account of its Marxian origins is absurd. I just don't think it's very credible to argue that its origins are in Michel Foucault or postmodernism. And in any event, it's overstated but very much resembles the exaggerated fears that liberals in the Cold War conjured up in response to communism. And at least communism controlled a few states, but, you know, wokeism is a transient phenomenon of very few people, and, you know, it's proven evanescent in the sense that the Democratic Party has run against it and shown that it was pretty easy to moderate, and there are lots of stories about the contemporary election that suggest that it was very, you know, very like a very simple matter to, you know, offer different rhetorical priorities than in the year or so after the killing of George Floyd. I think that, you know, liberals have a lot to learn from Marxism. I think there's something to learn from like identity politics as well, because liberals were the first emancipators, and then they have to learn what the sources of oppression are. And when liberals embrace laissez-faire, as they did in the 19th century, or neoliberalism, they need to understand that those are also sources of oppression, new hierarchies. And critics of imperialism in the name of liberalism were right. And critics of the legacies of white supremacy and patriarchy in the name of liberalism, for a version of liberalism that was more credible to more people, those people were also right. So I think the idea that we should return to a kind of centrist liberalism that finds some new set of Stalinists to oppose, whether that enemy is external, like, Islamist terrorism or whatever, or internal, like woke mobs, is just always a symptom of the failure of liberals to understand that they're losing because their views aren't sufficiently emancipatory and appealing to enough people. And that's true in this current election.
Sure. And probably with that, I will end with this question, that if we have to present a substantial notion of liberalism, which should be appealing to the people, correct me if I am wrong. So you propose a set of principles, and that liberalism should embrace and justify it very boldly. The idea of progress, the idea of enlightenment, the perfectionism. And finally, you also advocate for a liberalism which should bring together freedom along with equality.
Yes.
So all of these are what you try to propose for a new model of, or probably a new reconceiving liberalism.
Yes. That's all right. And I think there are considerable resources for that kind of liberalism in liberal history, which doesn't mean I think there's some, proper liberalism that it's now time to just revive. I think, as I said, there's a lot to learn from, critics of neoliberalism and of racism and patriarchy, for that matter, which have new forms, and therefore the criticisms have to be new, and liberalism has to present a new face. But I also think that the 19th century shows us how liberals can evolve into new liberals who understand the new kinds of subordination that markets can bring, and have a debate about whether empire is beneficent as a tool of liberation or a mistake. And these are all like healthy debates, and I think there was a right side in those debates. And we're contemporary liberals have in a sense not learned from their own history, and that's because this stance that the Cold War liberals offered is comfortable. It allows you to say the problem is always the despot abroad, or nowadays the despotic candidate whom you can't beat or barely can beat. And that's not a recipe for survival, let alone the flourishing of liberalism, because it's just not appealing enough, and it turns out regularly to be about kind of complicity with forms of subordination that liberals were born to oppose.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, for your time. It was really great chatting with you, and I invite our audience to read this fantastic book, Liberalism Against Itself: Cold War Intellectuals and the Making of Our Times. It has many, many nuanced ideas about our contemporary crisis and how liberalism should look forward to its future. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.